Let's sing and swing.
Evening visit with Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon in Manila.
Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowther, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines. Episode 24, No Good Deed. Previously on Forbidden Diary.
Dottie came hurrying into the dorm looking for Peg. The Japanese had just dropped off Peg's husband, Walter, at the guardhouse.
Peg, it's your husband. He just came into camp.
We heard today that families are going to be allowed to live together. And Wilma and Clifford are getting married.
And now, episode 24.
March 15, 1944. Betty gave a grand bridal shower for Wilma, decorating with her embroidered cloth, pink candlesticks, and a low pewter bowl with Jane's exquisite flower arrangement. She really shot the works on all of the extra special food. Meanwhile, arguments over family life are still going on, with couples buzzing and knots of disturbed single women and grumpy single men grouping to complain, grouse, or sound off in horror. One woman said, very high hat,
"This is neither the time nor the place to ask for such a thing."
Time nor place. What a bunch of malarkey. Speaking of which, a truck from Manila arrived loaded with barbed wire for the fence the Japanese are planning to put up around camp. But it also carried mail, Red Cross medicine, mostly vitamins, a box of recreational equipment, and Walter's baggage from Manila. 9,270 pesos in relief funds came in, along with June's antuitrin, thank God, to prevent her from hemorrhaging. In Japanese class, Miss McKim told us about Mr. Tomibe's English lessons.
Tomibe-san tried to tell me in English about his car trip and running out of gasoline. Every time he reached a certain point in the telling, he would say in his Nipponese English, and when we reached there, we got some. But his English is very good. He told me about an argument that he had with Lieutenant Hanada over how poorly Lieutenant Hanada treats us internees. It ended with Tomibe-san pointing to Lieutenant Harada's shoulder insignia and yelling,
"If you are of that opinion, you had better take off your insignia of rank and go back to Japan."
Then Lieutenant Harada shouted back at him,
"And if you are of that opinion, you had better take off your insignia of rank and go back to Japan."
Tomibe-san says his Japanese friends insist that he's too lenient and that he'll receive a medal from the American government after the war.
What'd he say to that, Miss McKim?
Tomibe-san told them that our executive committee does not think he is lenient.
Has he told you anything about himself?
Well, he has a wife. They were married 7 years ago at the beginning of the China War. He told me,
"あなたに恋をしたんです。I, what do you call in love?"
Well, that sure tells you why he's letting families live together, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does. He was in the military reserves for 7 years and had been sent to China, Manchukuo, and then here to the Philippines. He's only been home for 2 years.
Does he have any children?
Uh-huh. A boy, age 4, and a girl, 6. He graduated from Kyoto University and is a lawyer. He obviously comes for money. I think he's the best commandant we've had by far.
Well, Nakamura and Mr. Hayakawa aren't much competition.
True, but he's making a real attempt to understand and fix our problems. And he's clever enough to do it, too. He says that he's trying to treat us the way he would want to be treated if the situation were in reverse.
The golden rule.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's very Christian of him.
I believe Mr. Tomibe is a man of conscience.
March 16, 1944. I was walking back from the dining hall when Dottie called to me from a dorm window.
Hey, Natalie! Y'all expecting some things from Baguio?
No. Why?
Well, the truck's brought a lot of boxes and bags with your name on them. I think you got a big old steamer trunk, too.
Astonished, I rushed out to the bag table where there were two of our suitcases and other things. The soldier told me it would have to be examined, so I tore out to the woodshed to tell Jerry. His jaw dropped, and with a whoop, he lifted the sledge and let it fall with a terrific wallop. Two guards went through the black trunk full of clothes, two suitcases, the bag of silver, a wooden jewel box, and a cardboard box of ivories. The ivories and silver have moved 5 times since they left our house. They went to our friends, the DeBoers, who have moved twice. To Carl's house in Baguio, then here. With moving, looting, and emergency prospects, the DeBoers did not want further responsibility as the end of the war nears. And I don't blame them. Carl described how Nita and Ismael and Jorge had carried and carted the clothes over 4 miles across town on many trips. Every bit of silver, every piece of ivory was there, except the carved ball, which was left on a table. The silver is just as I packed it after the first bombings in 1941, and the ivories as I packed them away 4 Christmases ago. There's not only the silver I packed, but all the loose pieces which were left in the drawer and gathered up by Nita. The big leather suitcase and gray army suitcase were full of clothes, dresses, sweaters, stockings, underwear, orange embroidered Chinese pajamas, the black satin embroidered ones, wool suits and pants of Jerry's, oriental silks and colors tumbling into the drabness of concentration pell-mell. Oh, we went through each case, covering the bed with rainbow shades. My jewelry, except for the empty boxes which held the valuable pieces that the Japanese stole from our safety deposit boxes during our first weeks of internment, was there. It is almost a burden, but exciting, stimulating to have these ghosts from the past coming into my mind, which has been detached and made into a new mold. I feel that I want to share what has come in without effort on my part, almost undeserved. So I'm going to give away some things. First, June's dresses are too young and outgrown, and there are only 6, as the rest were looted. So I'll take 3 to Anne and 3 to Peg's girls. The silver pusher and baby spoon go to John Hay. A curved spoon to Susan, and a straight-handled spoon to Anne. The Red Cross bath towels go to Ruth and Jane, as well as a large pair of black sateen trousers that Jerry used for a costume at some club party. I'm sure material can be made into a skirt. While packing, repacking, and storing the cases under the bed, we found a second box of ivories. Jerry and I have had waves of gratefulness for our faithful Nita and Ismael. The risks they took showed in the candle wax on many fabrics, indicating the dangers of being caught and charged with looting.
March 17, 1944. Executive Committee Minutes. Father Sheridan presented a plan drawn up by 3 volunteers interested in the Family Unit Project. In it, spaces were allocated for couples with and without children. Dr. Skirl reported the work to date at Trinidad Garden Site and stated that little could be done until seeds, fertilizer, water, and a number of other items necessary to such an agricultural project are supplied. Preliminary preparation of soil is being carried on in one section of the camp's plot.
March 18, 1944. Peg's husband, Walter, seems to be settled into camp. After Japanese class, I joined Jerry, Bill Moole, Walter, and Peg on the back porch for coffee and muffins, where we listened to Walter's saga of Davao and Manila. He and Peg were separated early in the war when the Japanese sent him to a work camp near Davao City on the island of Mindanao. We sat spellbound as Walter talked about what happened in Davao after the first bombings and his harrowing sea journey to Manila before the Japanese finally transferred him up here to Camp Holmes.
Oh, yeah. We sailed up to Manila from Davao on a real luxury liner. The Japanese forced us below deck, so we bunked with the rats for the whole trip.
That's a hell of a long boat ride.
No kidding. We spent 4 days in the dark. There were no portholes, and a lot of men got typhus from rats' fleas.
Ugh. Well, were you glad to get to Manila? I mean, was it any better than Davao City?
I don't know. It was all lousy. The camp where I stayed in Manila was crammed with a hell of a lot of people. I think they ran out of space before the last 1,000 prisoners arrived. Geez, they must have had, I don't know, maybe 5 times the number of people as here. What's that, 2,500? And they had blackouts every night. One switch turned off all the lights. Well, except for the blue lights in the toilets. A guy who'd been there since 41 told me that the guards had taken everyone's electrical stuff. You know, hot plates and light bulbs. That was pretty recent, but I think things are going to get a lot worse down here. Man, I'm eternally grateful that Peg and the kids ended up here.
Were you in Davao at the beginning of the war?
Yep, sure was.
What was that like? There's a huge Japanese population down there.
I think that there was something like 20,000 before the war.
What happened December 8th?
You mean after the first bombings by the Japanese?
Yeah.
Well, one thing that happened was a lot of Japanese families fled across the rivers to the mountains.
Why'd they do that?
They were afraid of retaliation. Some drowned, and the ones who stayed were interned and treated pretty bad.
That's what happened here. They interned Japanese civilian men at Camp John Hay.
It was pretty ironic that when the Japanese took over, we swapped places with them.
The switchover on Mindanao was brutal. Something like 10,000 starving Japanese came back to Davao from hiding and looted every store and house in the city.
Jeez, what a mess.
Those were rough days. The Japanese internees became our guards, and they wanted payback.
We didn't have food or water for days. Remember how the men had to dig the privies without any shovels?
Did they make you sign a loyalty oath?
In Manila, yeah. But we protested that we'd be signing under duress, and the Japanese backed off.
We had to sign ours, but they let us attach letters of protest for all the good it did us.
Yeah, in Davao, they asked us to sign a document saying that we volunteered to help rebuild roads.
High command wants us to turn in the name of tradesmen, but we refused.
Well, all except Ray.
That's because the Japanese already know Ray's a diesel mechanic.
Yeah, and he and the Japanese both know that Ray's in the catbird seat, because their trucks won't run without him.
March 21, 1944. After lunch, my name was posted as having a note from Baguio, so I went to the office to receive 220 pesos in Japanese government bills for my dresses that I'd sold. First, we ate gold watches. Now it is velvet, taffeta, and felt. Well, at least we're not eating our integrity and self-respect. When I hear some of the comments around here, I have to grind my teeth. One man announced that he never expects to pay what he has borrowed from people living on the outside while he was in here. He prefers to go bankrupt instead. What an attitude to take. We'll be only too glad to pay every cent, even if it takes several years. It was the difference between life and death for June, health or wretchedness for the four of us, and can never be fully repaid for all it did to sustain us mentally and physically.
Camp Holmes Daily News. One of the camp's pigs developed hog cholera, and within 3 days, 4 swine have died. A veterinarian came out to Camp Holmes to investigate and administer the vaccine, but fears we will have to kill all of our pigs, as the strain is virulent, highly contagious, and usually fatal. Both internees and guards have lost livestock.
It's too bad the Japanese didn't isolate their new livestock for a few days. The pigs can't even be eaten because they were infected. What a tragedy. In these times especially, we all feel the pinch. March 22nd, 1944. On Monday, we had a change of guards. Our guards have to be replaced every so often before they become too soft. Those departing always go about the night before, chatting with friends for the last time, giving out candy to their favorite children. We undermine the common soldier. He likes us, and we feel friendly toward him. One guard, watching the wood crew, remarked apropos of nothing to one of the men.
Japanese government is not good.
His announcement was received in silence. The guards have been avidly interested in every detail of the Red Cross shipment. They all want to go to America after the war ends and think it is wonderful that the U.S. government sends all that to mere civilians. One even remarked that after the war here, Japanese, Americans, and Filipinos get along together. March 23rd, 1944. Wilma and Clifford were married today. Much preparation had gone into every detail. The piano was moved down to the church garden. White sheets were laid to make a narrow aisle from the hospital to a fern-trimmed bower. Each peg holding the strips down was decorated with pine spray, the green at intervals being very effective. Many wore evening gowns or coats, and everyone dressed up, if only a little. I wore my brocade Chinese coat, the Genoa pink corals, jade engagement ring, and grandmother's diamond for the first time in 2.5 years. I received a number of compliments. The green outdoors made a happy setting. A thin mist came and went in wisps and streamers. It was so peaceful. Mary started the ceremony by singing Because and Oh Promise Me. Then, to the slow, stately strains of Here Comes the Bride, the bridal procession came down the slope toward the two ministers who both performed the marriage ceremony. The attendants wore powder blue gowns with bouquets of pink and white sweet peas. Betty's white satin gown from Saks Fifth Avenue was lovely on Wilma, who lifted the tulle veil from her face as she reached the altar. Along the upper bank, in a row, sat a number of spectators, including small children deeply absorbed in the wedding ceremony. They have heard nothing but wedding, wedding, wedding for weeks. On a bench at the guardhouse were a row of guards with 6 or 8 Igorot children, whose eyes were glued on the ceremony. When the service was completed, the bride fairly jazzed up the aisle, then ran down the slope with her new husband. There was a long receiving line of good wishes, then to sign the guest book. The 4-layer wedding cake was surrounded by the Wiley's sterling and my recently returned silver flatware on a beautiful embroidered cloth. Mr. Tomibe has been much interested in this wedding, and just before the ceremony drove in from town with a vivid bouquet of pink dahlias and calla lilies, a bottle of sake, and a bottle of whiskey for the bride and groom. He was all dressed up, watching the ceremony closely, and afterward congratulated the couple, assisted by Miss McKim. He signed the guest book and mingled with the 500 guests. Earlier, he had given us all permission to dance till 9:25 in the evening. For the first time in 2 years, I felt like dancing, both mentally and physically. I felt like Cinderella leaving her mops behind. We waltzed, one-stepped, two-stepped, and foxtrotted, throwing in a few other slides for good measure. Petey and June danced together. June danced with her dad and learned to follow. At the end, Walter drove the bridal pair around the parade ground, then down to the hospital in the Lincoln car, with clattering tin cans tied by Larry on the back. Fern and Cleo gave up their big front room for the couple, and just before lights out, some of their closest friends serenaded them with tin cans. Ruthie, who was the only unmarried attendant, caught the bride's bouquet. It is always over so quickly, after the endless preparations taking weeks. It was a happy occasion, but everyone felt let down. tired after all the hard extra work, gaiety, and hectic excitement. Back at the women's barracks, some of us were too keyed up to sleep and got to talking about married and single life.
It really was a lovely wedding.
Indeed. And Grace and Anne, adorable little flower girls, weren't they?
Maybe there will be another wedding from sheer contagion.
Oh, I hope not. I'm still pooped from this one.
Did you see that Mr. Tomibe signed the wedding book, Miss McKim?
I did.
Ooh, what did he write?
He wrote, "Congratulations. May happiness lie in your future."
You know, this wedding has had me thinking about the family unit plan. It really is upsetting the apple cart.
I don't think so. It's returning things to the way they should be.
But married life isn't normal anymore, is it? I mean, not now, when we've been living the single life for 2 years. You know, this is the first time in my married life that I've been free enough from child and family responsibilities to do other things, like go back to nursing, which I'm really enjoying.
Yes, but we're in a unique situation. The camp takes care of home duties like cooking and childcare.
I know, but in some ways, I like my life in here.
Well, you're never lonely, I'll give you that.
Oh, heavens no, that's for sure.
I'm just saying that there's something to be said for the way we're living in here. Just look at the single people who found companionship. And we've all made friends that we'd never have had time for in the past. The kids seem happier too, with so many friends to play with and all.
But they miss being with their parents.
Well, sink or swim, they're sure learning how to get along with people. I'll give you that.
Personally, I'd find this experience so much more enjoyable if we had food.
I wonder, when the war is over and we've gone our separate ways, will we miss camp life?
No.
Maybe some things, I suppose.
I'm going to miss all of the jokes and camaraderie and freedom.
Freedom? What are you talking about, Clara?
You're just being sentimental because it was such a good day.
No, I don't think so, Millie.
You'll be back to being miserable at breakfast when you get a look at your little bowl of pasty rice and spoiled cabbage.
As I sat listening to my dorm mates, I thought when we leave this life, many will be maladjusted, cranky, and unhappy. And we won't know why. It will be a form of homesickness for the years that we tried to work together and didn't do so badly, managed to live with people we never dreamed we could get along with, and had fun doing it too. Thanks to rice machines, peanut machines, and banana machines. March 26, 1944. I went down to look at Wilma's wedding gifts displayed on tables for everyone to view. About one-third of the camp, her most intimate friends, gave presents. Some had given personal silver spoons and forks. You could tell who had things rescued or sent in. On one table were all the handmade gifts, like the bamboo salt and pepper jars with bark covers and a copper coffee pot beautifully hammered out by Jess. Another table contained all Red Cross items. Sheets, embroidered with their initials, bath and hand towels initialed, handkerchiefs, and pink step-in panties, all cleverly made into wedding gifts. March 27, 1944. Camp is preparing for General Coe's visit in every direction. Wooden signs with store, number one dorm, dentist, dispensary, are being painted with Japanese characters over each English word. Because of this, I had my first one-on-one encounter with Mr. Tomibe, who walked up to me, bowed, and pointed to a building, asking politely.
Excuse me, Mrs. Crowder. What is this building called?
It's called a bathroom, Tomibe-san.
Aha! Thank you.
He's even labeling people with armbands, which are being made by Velma in a hurry. After they've been sewed, black characters are painted on them, designating committee members, doctors, nurses, and so on. As Carl, Miss McKim, Mr. Tomibe and his staff reviewed preparations for the general's upcoming visit. Carl kidded Tomibe-san about the armbands. At first, Tomibe took him seriously.
Have the armbands been completed, Chairman Carl?
Yes, Tomibe-san, but there is a problem.
What is it?
Now everyone in camp wants an armband, even the wood crew.
Huh?
Jodan desu yo, Tomibe-san. Carl is making a joke, Tomibe-san.
Narudo. I get it. Then they will get armbands too.
They'll be very pleased to hear that, Tomibe-san.
Now, let us continue talking about General Ko's visit. I must know this. How long does it take for cement to dry?
Pardon me? I don't understand.
I want to build a cement walkway for the General's visit.
I'd say at least a week. What do you think, Arthur?
That sounds about right.
But it must be dry by tomorrow.
Cement no kawari ni sheets o tsukau no wa dou kana? How about using sheets instead of cement?
これでは、これでは皇太子を振動みたいに歩くぞ。 Then, General Ko can walk through camp like a bride.
What's so funny, Miss McKim?
They're suggesting that General Ko could walk on the white sheets Wilma and Clifford used as a path to their wedding altar. They're being very disrespectful.
Could you tell him about the fish? He needs to go over to the kitchen and see it.
Tomibe-san, Arthur wa kitchen de shireteiru sakana nitsuite hanashitai mitai desu.
Naze desu ka, Makimu-san?
Tomibe-san ni mite hoshii mitai desu.
Kaigi no ato daidokoro e ikimashou to kare ni tsutaete kudasai.
Tomibe-san says he and his staff will go over to the kitchen after the meeting, Arthur.
Thank you, Tomibe-san. Hey, Alex, show Tomibe-san the fish we've been getting.
Okay, but stinks when I open ice box.
As you can see, Tomibe-san, the gills are green.
He's no good. I can't cook.
You must understand, Chef Alex. Food is limited for everyone. Japanese soldiers do not eat better than prisoners.
Okay. I sent fish to guardhouse for dinner.
Yamero!
Yamero!
No!
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 ありえない! 私はそれほど空腹ではない!
腐った魚など食えるか!
もういい!
I am not eating rotten fish.
They're dead! They're dead! They're...
Tomibe-san!
My god, Smitty! Who's dead?
Two of the pigs!
Are they my pigs?
Gee, I don't know, Mr. Sato. They all look the same to me.
I just spent 600 pesos on those pigs!
They're better be alive! 6ヶ月も貯金したんだぞ! What the hell?
あら, 誰か佐藤さんについてった方がいいでしょうか?
Oh dear, would you like someone to go after poor Mr. Sato, Tomibe-san?
彼のことは後で私が対応します。 Thank you, Miss McKim. I will deal with him later. Mr. Smitty, do you know how the pigs died?
We're pretty sure it's fish poisoning.
You sure, Smitty?
See? What I tell you. Even pigs can't eat fish.
March 28, 1944. General Ko arrived late morning and made the rounds with about 8 officers. I was a bit surprised to see that he's an elderly and benign-looking man with a long face. He toured the machine and shoe shops, hospital, private kitchens, dorms, and livestock pens housing our surviving pigs. In honor of the visit, we ate pate and good rice, then saw the Marx Brothers Go West and cartoons down in the church garden on a big sheet that was stretched on bamboo for a screen. Two guards and a young Filipino sweated over the projector,
But the kids had a grand time. June said she was disgusted with all the movie actors, thought them terrible smoothies, hated the kissing and mush. Oh, she shows all the signs of concentration complex. No affection, no loving, or holy matrimony. All taboo. It shows a little of what can be done in molding of the young. The question of family living quarters was taken up with General Ko. He said we cannot construct new buildings, but if something could be arranged in the present buildings, he would not be opposed to it. March 29, 1944. Outside contacts are very dangerous at the moment, so it is time to lay low. No more messages from the hill, no more bird calls, no more secret contact with Igorot friends. I went a week without an ascorbic acid shot, and sure enough, a first canker appeared and multiplied, so I had to go back on vitamin C. I'm hardly the only one. Many have mouths being treated with vitamin C, along with two bad cases of beriberi, with swollen legs to the thighs, swollen face, etc. There is much athlete's foot in camp, too. March 30, 1944. Miss McKim told us about a special executive committee meeting with Mr. Tomibe and Mr. Suda. The topics were etiquette and prison escapes.
And there was Mr. Suda calling us all one big family and asking why can't we act more friendly when he comes around.
Gee, I wonder why. What did you tell him?
I suggested that there was a time when we were slapped by guards and that perhaps we remembered it.
What did he say?
Nothing. I had him there.
Y'all sure did. Remember how Mr. Suda treated us at Brent School when we struggled with our bags and things?
I sure do.
Well, then Mr. Suda backpedaled a bit and said that young and old internees are almost always courteous, but the rest of us show open resentment.
Well, isn't he a delicate little flower?
Carl explained to him that most of us have never experienced military discipline, and that if we go about our work without seeming to acknowledge the presence of a soldier, we're not aware of giving any offense.
Carl's such a diplomat.
Did Mr. Tomibe buy it?
I think so. But manners are important to Japanese.
Oh yeah, and Mr. Suda's a regular Emily Post. Who cares about Mr. Suda? What about Mr. Tomibe?
I think that he doesn't have much to give his men. And this is something he can do for them with little impact on us. After the meeting, he asked me to draft a message telling our work crews to say, good morning, or how do you do to the guards.
Is that a fact? Huh. Well, I suppose some of those work crew guys could stand to learn some manners.
Well, then Mr. Tomibe got down to the real reason for the meeting. He warned the general committee that if anyone were to escape and get caught, they'd be put in jail, and it would not be pleasant.
Well, that came out of nowhere. Why'd he say that?
General Ko must have said something about escapes during his visit.
Why would anyone be stupid enough to try to escape? There's nowhere to go.
Some people tried to escape in Manila. That's why General Ko is having the fence built around camp. Something must be going on, because before I left the meeting, Tomibe-san said he had something of General Ko's for me to translate tomorrow.
March 31st, 1944. The following is a notice from the Commandant. Because of an incident where two internees at Santo Tomas left prison to go to a bar in Manila, High Command has ordered that all prisoners in camps where such infractions occur must be penalized. As a punishment for this incident, Santo Tomas Prison now has a 2 a.m. roll call. The Commandant does not wish to have a roll call at Camp Holmes at inconvenient hours and makes a personal request to the internees of this camp to follow the rules so that the whole camp will not be forced to suffer for the indiscretions of a few. If the military police made any complaint in connection with this camp, the Commandant would receive all of the blame and shoulder all of the responsibility for allowing an infraction of the rules should the person be found guilty.
April 1st, 1944. A python on the hill is getting some of the younger chickens in the camp hen house. April 2nd, 1944. About 10 pigs have died, in spite of serum shots, which is a tragic burial of relief money for all of us. April 5th, 1944. An hour after lights out, everyone was rousted out of a dead sleep for roll call. In the men's and women's barracks, dorm monitors called out numbers under the watchful eyes of the guards.
Number 314.
Here.
Number 317.
Yo.
319.
Daddy, here. Why are they doing this?
I have no idea, Petey.
I'm cold.
Here, take my coat.
330. 330. Number 330.
Who is 330?
Richie?
Do any of you know where this Richie is? Haruki! Ishikawa! Toilet o sagashite koi!
Hai! Hai!
After roll call is finished, all of you will be questioned. Continue.
Number 441?
Здесь. Here.
452.
Here.
453.
Psst. Have you seen Richie?
No. You see Wick?
No.
Ah, crap.
532. Number 532.
Richie and Wick did not show up for roll call and have not been found. Jerry heard that they had passes for the hill today. No one saw them this evening or remembered seeing them during the day. This is just unbelievable. After all of Mr. Tomibe's warnings and efforts to make our lives better, none of his good deeds will go unpunished. Not for him, for us, or for Wick and Richie. If caught, it will be fatal for them.
This concludes episode 24. Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.